The best way to start the day is having a café con leche. We live in Miami for 7 years, so definitely café con leche was the first thing in the morning. And we are going to make a Bustelo coffee, which goes as an espresso. We're going to make the shot first. And we then preparing our cup. And there we go. Look at that golden, delicious coffee coming out of there. Then the main thing in a cafe con leche, of course, is the sugar. Sugar, it goes before anything else, mix the espresso with the sugar. Then we're going to steam the milk. We definitely make a lot of different versions of it. For the vegans, we have definitely all plant-based milks, from oatmeal, coconut milk, and we also have non-fat, but the original is with milk. So for people who doesn't like the bitterness of a coffee, definitely this is the way to go. So we steam the milk and then we mix it with the coffee. The differences between a latte or a cappuccino, they are stronger. And that's the reason why I don't like cappuccino or latte. If it's not, I have to tell them to put in more milk. But the whole thing with this is have to be warm, good, all natural. No syrups, just coffee, milk, and sugar. And now let's start our day.
And we're back.
Here we are.
I'm Ken.
I'm Jeanette.
We're the owners of Buenos Dias Cafe.
La Bodega.
And this is the Kosher Guacamole Podcast.
Live from the
Where
Met.
Are we? There we go, the Met.
Ay, Dios mío.
The adios mio at the end is the key. Make sure you get that. Last time we were together, we talked about how we got here. From San Francisco, El Salvador, New York, Miami, and now we're here. This time we're going to talk about what here is. When we moved to Atlanta, we moved to a neighborhood known as Grant Park. When I lived here previously, one of my closest friends was one of the urban pioneers that lived over there, and I had seen the neighborhood grow, and I liked the connection to the community, the location for downtown. The company I worked for went under, and Jeanette and I decided that instead of me going to ply my trade with another company, it was time to go out on our own. We had been here 5 years. We had felt the lay of the land and what was going to happen. And we were researching a restaurant in our neighborhood when I went downtown to meet with the SBA and saw a space available in the building that the SBA was in, which was part of the Georgia State University community.
And one of the neighbors of meetings with Carter in Summerhill, we were, you know, still checking the project and how they work. They said immediately when they saw us, like, oh, we have the perfect place for you guys, which, you know, is the Met. So we come and check it out, which Ken already knew the space. We knew exactly what it was. And immediately, you know, we visioned, you know, the whole idea of being a community shop, being in an area that is coming alive, where it was so much needed.
I don't think we ever said we were just going to force Buenos Dias on this area. We said we would see what this area was missing. Turns out this area was missing even more than we realized. The Met itself is over 1 million square feet and never had any food in it for all of its workers and people who live here. And then you have two neighborhoods right here in Adair Park and West End, and we are on the corner of where Adair Park meets the West End, that are both designated by federal government standards as food deserts. And then you have other communities in the immediate area like Westview, Capitol View, and that's constantly where our customers tell us that they're coming and how they just haven't had any extra choice is such an excitement for them, because as these people are moving here, they're just finding that there's not as much here for them as they had hoped. Jeanette and I were in the Design District in Miami way before Wynwood was cool and the Design District was had sneaker shops and pop-ups. There was this little restaurant that kind of carved its way out to make itself work. It wasn't ours. It was just the one that we went to every morning to get coffee. And I remember thinking, if they could just wait it out, they clearly are on the path to having all the infill around them that they'll be a thriving business. But it's hard. Restaurant margins are very tight, and you have to bring in fresh fruit all the time and pay people to work, even if you're not that busy. And so I feel like we're that in that where you're driving down Murphy, or if you're in this property, you see us after a bunch of empty buildings that are going to get infilled. You see all the development ideas that are coming through all the way up to the giant West End Mall project, which is a couple years away. But we're already here, and we'll be here whenever these things open. So
I think that's when there is misconception of what gentrification is and how we can actually educate the community to take advantage of the movement and how they can benefit from it and not be pushed out.
I think Atlanta has learned from the mistakes of some communities, and I think Adair Park in particular, we're particularly involved in, is aggressively making sure that things are done so that the community can grow together instead of these giant infills of apartment buildings and lack of infrastructure to support these kinds of things, both on the civic and on the commercial side. One of the things I've been most impressed by is the drive for commercial support for the residents that are here that is recognized and needed. I think that was one of the big issues. It was a huge issue in Grant Park even in 2006. I had to drive so far just to get breakfast. There's nothing over there. It took Invest Atlanta really creating the Memorial Drive corridor to make that happen, and that's not necessarily the right answer either. That was kind of the solution to an existing problem. Adair Park and the West End developers are trying really hard to avoid those problems and grow it organically from day one with both housing and commercial support. One of the developers of the Design District was someone who had also developed a big project in Miami called Lincoln Road. And when we met with him in early 2000s, it was, I need to get the commercial businesses in here, not only to create traffic at night, but to give people a reason to want to live here. And Grant Park just sold people houses. I use Grant Park as an example because we live there and we've seen it change, but I'm sure Candler Park and all those can say the same thing, Old Fourth Ward. If you don't have a grocery store, if you don't have a drug store, if you don't have a community center, people aren't going to be as encouraged to live there, because even if they do move in, they won't stay, and that's what you want. At the same time, the people who have lived here all this time in Adair Park and haven't had these resources now have an opportunity to get these resources, and that would be a nice change for them too. And those can be done a lot faster than these new developments that take 3 years. We were listening in on the Murphy Crossing development Zoom meeting with the Beltline, and you know, people are talking about outdoor space for the artists and coffee shops. This is a project that at best will be done in 2023, and they're micromanaging what's going to be in the buildings. Let's get the bidding done. Let's set the parameters for how much housing should be there. Let's make sure there's a grocery store or a farmer's market. Those are the things you want, you know, large space. Whether or not there's going to be, you know, coffee served at the amphitheater isn't really as important. So I think these communities are realizing the mistakes made before and trying really hard to make sure that they're proactive in growing this with all the areas of need, instead of just letting the big money developers come in, throw up an apartment building with some, you know, live, work, play, right? What does that mean? You know, does that mean that the people who buy a $500,000 apartment can go to a fancy store underneath? You know, you need more than that. The city needs to get involved in making sure that infrastructure's there. I mean, the roads in and out of some of these neighborhoods are just going to get overcrowded, and then it's going to discourage people from using the resources that are being put in there. If they're not thinking about it in advance, then they're setting themselves up to fail. I mean, you come in off of certain streets. The Memorial Drive corridor is a two-lane road. It's you know, there's been, I think, $1 billion in investment in there, but they haven't widened the roads. So you're putting movie theaters and grocery stores in, and you still have the same two-lane roads you had when there was just 100-year-old homes in them. So it doesn't seem like it's going to make sense. And it's the same in the old Fourth Ward, right? It's the same intersection at Edgewood and whatever that crossroad is, and yet you got six bars there that are super packed. How is that safe? People are driving, you know, staggering out in the middle of the night. How about that giant building that's being, the apartments are being sold for millions of dollars on Marietta Street? That's a trucking road.
My name's Diva, and I've been working at the cafe for like 2.5 years now. Ken and Jeanette have basically been family ever since. Like, they're just like exact replicas of my parents. It's so funny.
I'm taller.
Significantly taller, but it's okay. Not to call you like a sailor mouth, but Ken definitely has a sailor's mouth. And like during this interview, this dude just starts cursing. Yes. And I go back to the table and I'm like, Dad, he was cursing. Like in the interview. I didn't know if it was normal, if I should say something, but yeah. It was really cool. It was so funny. It was the funniest experience. And then working in downtown, there's plenty of creeps that come in.
Oh, yeah.
And if one person says something wrong, all we got to do is tell Ken or whatever manager's on duty, and he's just pulling, like, Papa. And he's coming out Papa Bear, like, you better get out of here. You can't talk to these girls like that. Like,
right.
I grew up over here, too, like, before the Met actually became the Met. And it used to be, like, this dingy place. But now seeing it, like, blow up, like, there's so many people coming out. There's so many artists around here. And, like, we've definitely built, like, I'm not really sure what to call it, but like in downtown we had our own little scene, and over here now we have our own scene, our own regulars that come in, and we know like everyone like that. But we would have so many people come in and be like, you know, we only come in here because the girls are so nice,
right?
Like they love talking to us, and they're like, they're so friendly, and everyone's saying thank you. They, like, we're always making sure, like, hey, do you need another fork? I saw that you dropped that. Do you need more napkins? I'm gonna go grab that for you real quick. And it's kind of like, I love working behind a window, but like I really miss dressing the food, and I miss going to people and just like, you know, having that personal connect. Like, I love being nice to people. Like, food service has always been so, so easy for me. I feel like at the cafe though, it was such a small space, but it was so like high energy at the same time. Like, literally lunchtime, line out the door every day. And I miss that here kind of, but also the stress of it was kind of insane. Like, you're yelling at girls like, I need 5 coffees over here, and you're calling out names, you're, oh my God, I gotta go get the food, get the limes and stuff.
But was like, it real downtown energy versus over here?
For real, yeah. I remember once I opened up a morning and there was a guy just sleeping on the table. Like, it was like 7 a.m. and I was like, hey, like, why is there a guy sleeping at one of the front tables? And Jeanette was just like, he was tired, he needs to charge his phone, so I'm just gonna let him sleep. And I'm like, okay, well, I won't say anything. Once it gets busy, I'm gonna kick him out. So this, it goes, it's like 10 o'clock, he's still sleeping, charging his phone, and then this dude puts his feet up on the second table, and I was like, okay, now I'm disrespected, this is not your house. And I go back and I was like, Jeanette, you should come look at this guy. And she comes up and she's like, oh hell no. And she's pulling up her sleeves and she goes and she pulls the table underneath from his legs. And this dude's just like, oh my gosh, like, why did you do that? And she's like, this is my house. Like, who told you to put your feet on the table? And it was just, she just started going off on that. She's like, get your stuff, get out. And he just shoos away. And I was just like, that was the funniest thing I've ever seen in my life. She straight up just, get the heck out.
You know, we never thought about it, but when we were living in San Francisco, we were watching gentrification in two cycles. So gentrification isn't the bad word that people think it is. It's the money part behind it that becomes the bad word. I think, first of all, it's critical for cities to revitalize communities. That is absolutely critical, both for the survival of the cities, but also for the financial portion, tax revenue, right? Cities work off of tax dollars created. Property tax is a huge part. Sales tax is a huge part. If you can create an economy that people are contributing to the government coffers, you can get things done. So when one neighborhood on one side of 75 is contributing 4% of your city's revenue flow and another side is producing only 1%, there's a deficiency, and you need to get the other side up to the 4% as well. So the city becomes involved and tries to create ways to make people want to be in that part of the city. That's what the Memorial Drive corridor was, and that's what inevitably will come over here. But the thing that people get freaked out about is that the people who have been in these communities all these times get pushed out, and that's in quotes. But I don't know that that's necessarily fair, because cities take, or Atlanta gives homeowners an opportunity to keep their home. the tax break on your property tax is very strong. And at the same time, there are programs that allow you to make your payments viable for you based on your economic situation. What we don't do is we don't educate. We don't let people know that not only that they don't need to cash out on their house, but that if they do, there's not going to be somewhere where they can go. So that's the challenge that I think some, I don't know if it's some nonprofit needs to get funded by the city or through some advocacy work, but that needs to change. But if a community in the city becomes a better place for people to live, to go to school, to work, everybody rises up. A better school is a better thing. In Grant Park, the old Southside High School became Maynard Jackson High School, got a $30 million T-Splots, which is the 1% tax, the one penny tax, built this gorgeous building, got the community involved, and now competes with Grady to be the second highest rated school in the city behind Northside. That's not a bad thing, to have another good school. It's not didn't make Grady worse, it just made the old Southside, now Maynard Jackson, better. That everybody wins, right? Better that people want to live there, you have more educated children, higher rate of acceptance to going to college. There's everything anybody's looking for. So the same thing should happen over here, right? Now all these schools will become better because there'll be more civic involvement. That's never a bad thing. One of the problems in the South is not the focus on the transition of kids from middle school to high school to college. So I don't know that gentrification is this big bad voodoo word that people say, but you have to also not price out the community. One of the big things that Jeanette and I feel frustrated about is our teachers aren't part of the communities. I remember my fourth grade teacher driving up to the basketball court on his motorcycle and taking kids for rides because he had this cool motorcycle, because he lived down the street in New York. So if you can do it in New York, you can certainly do it in Atlanta.
And that's one of the things that the city should be demanding. Developers, they have tax breaks, for God's sake. You know, and I think that a percentage of the teachers that are in each school, police, teachers, why they have to be driving 2 hours to come to work? It should be in the contract.
It's crazy because our daughter's sixth or seventh grade year, I forget which one it was, but four of her five subject teachers had just graduated from Georgia State within the last 3 years. So they all had been in Atlanta. And if they had been given the opportunity to buy or rent in the community, they would have. They were going to school in the downtown area, and then they were working 2 miles away from where they went to school. Logically, they'd want to stay in the community. But either they earn too little or the housing prices weren't accommodated for the public sector worker, right? That's always, you see it, and there's a couple city council, I think Matt Westmoreland's pretty big on it, that you have to create a certain percentage. But the dollar amount that they're setting doesn't make any sense. So, and the Board of Education, the Atlanta Board is a completely separate body, but it's still part of the civic government, and they can control, as part of the programming, how they're going to get these teachers in. They're hiring young teachers all the time. Teachers leave, and they always need to bring more. So why can't they create some kind of program where there's an incentive for the teachers to be in town? It would be a better quality workspace. So the affordable housing numbers aren't economically viable for what first-year teachers, third-year teachers make in the Atlanta public school system. I don't know how you could do it without it being income, but you need to somehow create an incentive program for teachers that there's a rent credit or there's a home purchase credit so that teachers stay longer. Maybe that's the idea, is if you have to stay, that way reduce turnover. You have to stay 10 years and then it's forgiven, but you've rented your house for free or you bought your house. But if you don't, you have to start paying it back so that when you leave to go to a different school system, you take that into consideration.
My name is Christina. I came to Buenos Dias Cafe sophomore year. I was looking for a job and I actually started right away. I just walked right back and they were like, well, here's all this stuff. Are you ready to start? And I'm like, oh no. Because I had like my...
I remember those shoes. I remember yeah. Your handbag.
I was looking pretty spiffy to say so myself. And she was like, no, you gotta get started. You gotta start making tacos. I'm like, okay, I'll come back. that they're my second parents. Maybe sometimes my first, if my first parents aren't up to par, but I really, really love them. I always try to come visit them.
Part of coming into a new community and bringing the community up with you is recognizing what you're, what's here now and what you're going to avoid in the future. One of the things we did in researching the food desert communities is one of the frustrations of the federal government is the corporate restaurants, the dollar meals. That is a huge challenge that they're trying to figure out how to eliminate. And it's easy to drop a McDonald's on a street corner. You know, just some plumbing, some electric, some gas, and a prefabbed building, and you're up and running. But that doesn't serve the community. The onset of diabetes, heart disease, blood pressure problems in these communities is just gigantic. And there's a perception that either this is what the communities are used to, so that's what they want, or because these corporations use so much salt and sugar that they're, in essence, addicted to this food. And it's the job of individual restaurant operators to keep people away from wanting this food. The best way to do it is to just allow more different types of restaurants to become available so that people have the choices that make the most sense to them. The opportunity is when you get here, when I say here to the West Side in this case, before all these corporations start coming in. When we were talking about infrastructure, one of the things that corporations, fast food restaurants use is how many cars pass by per minute and how many would pull off and use their drive-through. What we're given the opportunity to do is not measure that and instead measure the people that are around us and how we can serve them. And then other entrepreneurs in the community will do that too. We can't possibly serve everybody everything they need. So someone's going to come along and say, oh, those people who used to own Buenos Dias and now own the bodega just do Latin food. I'm going to bring Korean food, and they're going to, there's going to be a need for it, and it's going to be fresh and new and different and received by another portion of the community and be a better choice than the Golden Arches. So I think that food, sir, you know, the great thing about food is that no matter how much you ate yesterday, you're still going to need to eat tomorrow. So we every day have a chance to wipe the slate clean and serve people food again. And over the course of three meals a day, 7 days a week, there's an opportunity for somebody to come and try your food and then hopefully come back for more. And if you can keep doing that, then you will build a business that's thriving and also give other people inspiration to come in here and as the independent business. And hopefully the city and the community will want to see those businesses and not the corporations that don't create a lot of jobs, that don't serve any health needs in the community, and really don't generate revenue because the money goes back to the corporation, doesn't stay in the community.
Definitely it's not local, you know. We are hoping that after the pandemic and everybody who have been staying home and not really, you know, going out and start searching for local independent restaurants, that they keep doing it. Because also, that's part of the community, and that's the community's job as well. If they want local, they need to support local. You know, back home, there is no change. You know, it's always just the one butcher. Then we had the fishermen, which I was lucky enough to live 2 hours away from the lake. So the fishermen, you know, pass by your house practically and selling the fish. And then we had the baker, right? And we have the person who brings all the vegetables and, you know, all other needs and whatever is available for the season. So that's one of the things that I would like to see more. I would love to eventually in La Bodega have a local butcher. Can you imagine that? Where you can actually come and just take whatever had been grown down, you know, south of Georgia or north of Georgia. And the chicken, the eggs, and all that, you know. as much as we complain about gentrification, it sometimes it's our fault as well. Because we decide the easy way. Like, can say, just pull in to a drive-thru because you don't even want to get out of the car. You know, and instead of going in and talk to the person who is actually serving the food. By week two, you should know that David liked his coffee with no cream, no sugar. That is community.
We never, at Buenos Dias or here, we never gave, like, numbers when your order was ready or, like, a little card that we could just walk around and match it. We always took names so that we could just constantly be repeating people's names. And the idea was that you would remember the name. Ideally, well, you know, if you're seeing enough customers enough times, you'll record their names. But it's also because you don't want to treat people like a number. Number 32, number 30, that's awful. That's just you never think about it. It's just a system, but it's just you're missing a touch, right? You're missing the chance to connect with somebody. Oh, my sister's name is the same as yours, yeah. You know? Oh, that's my wife's name. Oh, that's, you know.
Oh, you spell it crazy like my wife.
Yeah.
Two N's, two T's, you know.
Well, but that's, getting back to the original point, that's what you avoid in gentrification is if you have a bunch of businesses that are the uniqueness of the proprietor and the people that work there. Because at McDonald's, there's a name tag, you know, it's, and you don't even, if they even have that anymore, I have no idea. The challenge in keeping individuality in the marketplace is to really let the community know who you are. And there's corporations that are masking themselves by creating new brands and new names that aren't necessarily really part of the community. They're just trying to create like a vibe that would be part of the community.
A facade.
Yeah, I mean, you know, interior designs and engineers can easily make things look like the cool place and that everybody else, the real individuals are building. But then if you dig deep, you'll find that there's, you know, billion dollar corporations behind them. And consolidation of businesses is also going to be a big factor, that someone that might have been a cool independent for a while suddenly was bought up. H&F Bread was just bought by Engelmann's, and our friend who works there is like, I'm going to just be able to make cookies now. And he's a classically trained French baker. You know, it's like they're losing a giant talent, and, you know, they're going to keep the brand name, but they're not going to be making, it's going to be made on these machines by people who have been making Kroger grocery buns, you know? So I think it sucks when development comes to the point where the only people that get an opportunity to come in are the partners that can commit to six spaces in six different cities or in six different spots around the city, and the individuals lose it. And what really stinks, if you think about it, is the reason that people went there first in the Beltline's case is because it was getting cool. There were people there that were making it work and realized the potential of what that neighborhood was. And I think the West Side could face the same problem. One or two of those breweries on the West End could get bought, and then all of a sudden that individuality is lost. And if the supporting buildings around it don't become something interesting, then what do we have? I think there's three projects on Murphy besides Crossing where they're talking about live, work, play, and, you know, all this retail underneath. But who's going to go in there? Who's going to pay $22 a square foot to be on the West Side Beltline? Who, you know, an individual, a small business can't afford it. You know, we charge our pop-ups $75 a day. You know, and some of them are like, ooh, that's a lot. It, you know, if it is, but it's not, because it's an opportunity. You know, $75 a day over a month would be $2,000. You can't rent a restaurant for $2,000 a month. But these commitments to these, I guess, speculative land spaces make it so that the affordability factor isn't there. And I don't know how you get it to the point where you can make, I mean, look at Pond City Market, which has been a great success. But almost every restaurant in there was an established restaurant in the city who opened another outlet, and it was great for those, and they were at least independent outlets, but they were established. There was no startups. And so they just got a chance to expose themselves to what became a very popular site for both locals and tourism. But the kids, there's nobody here taking the kids that are trying to make a business here and expose them to all these people. And so that's what we're missing. And hopefully, I think ABI could do it, especially at Murphy Crossing, but they need to. that next episode when we dive into small business and relate the stories that we both have gone through and seen, you'll see that the need for these businesses to have opportunities is probably the biggest challenge to entry after financing. The bodega has given us an opportunity to reassess how we got here and what we were doing when we came here, taking into account the current times, also the neighborhoods that we're affecting. I think when we got here, we were really more focused on what the Met itself was going to be, because it's 1 million square feet, which is a lot. So we were just going to try and feed that. And by having to expand our reach to all the people who live here, we have learned so much more about the communities that are here and how accepting and grateful they are that we are here. And so we get to show them our gratitude by providing them with the food and service that we're ultimately going to do without us even realizing it. Thank you very much for listening to episode 2 of the Kosher Guacamole Podcast,
recorded live from La Bodega at the Met.
We'll put it all together next time with small business, the West End, and everything that we do.